baseball is almost back, Jeremy. As we're recording this episode, I know, spring training Cactus League games are in full swing. And as baseball fans, spring brings in the hope of fun outings at the ballpark or catching a fly ball or eating a ketchup-free hot dog and maybe doing the wave. But as sports medicine physicians, you and me, it also usually comes with a slew of arm injuries that we see in the training room or in the office as baseball players and really any overhead thrower at all levels from little to big league. Just recently, I read a headline about one of our former White Sox pitchers, Lucas Giolito. He's now in the Red Sox, who may be out for the season with a UCL, ulnar collateral ligament injury, or Tommy John, as I'm sure will be said many, many times in this episode. Real hot tip, though, for the record, Tommy John underwear, which, Jeremy, you've brought up in past episodes, and Tommy John, the famous pitcher who first received UCL, ulnar collateral ligament reconstructive surgery in 1974, have nothing to do with each other. So go figure.
He's not getting posthumous extra money for that. Is Tommy John dead? Is he alive?
No, he's alive. I think he's alive.
Yeah. And a correction on the posthumous, just humus money.
Humorous money, because that's part of the Tommy John ligament attachment. Jeremy, can you name any other notable or any other Major League Baseball players who have suffered a Tommy John injury?
Oh, maybe more than you want me to say, but Steven Strasburg, I feel, had it at least once or twice. Bryce Harper had it. There was Gleyber Torres, who was a shortstop. I feel like I've known two position players at this point.
Yeah.
Well, Shohei's definitely had it. He's all in the news. I feel like I want to try to get some older players that have had it. I always remember people saying Nolan Ryan never had it. So see, it proves that you can throw hard and not have a problem, which
correct.
We'll get to, obviously. Do you want me to keep going?
No, I mean, there was
Wood?
A list. Yeah.
There we go.
There you go.
There's
Kerry
an older
Wood.
One and Cubs.
I have a very short list that's picked by my biased Chicago-centric perspective, and I'm sure there's a lot of people on that list that you'd be like, oh yeah, huge deal, and I just didn't recognize because I love baseball, but I didn't necessarily pay attention to baseball in like the 1980s. but yeah, Jose Canseco in 1993 was a big one. Kerry Wood, you mentioned. Francisco Liriano, who I think is still playing baseball. That was in 06. Shin-Soo Choo in 2007. Shohei Ohtani, you mentioned. Probably times two. I don't know if he's had a second surgery for it yet, but I know that there was a more recent re-injury, which I'm excited to talk about our guest about, because that seems to be kind of the bigger problem, is this not happening just the first time. Maybe it's happening for the second time.
He had his second surgery, although they did not release any details on what was done, but
got it.
I think we have a slight idea of some of what was done.
Chris Sale in 2020, you mentioned Bryce Harper in 2022, and he basically had a crazy rapid return to play, probably since he's an outfielder and a DH and you know, a hitter. And then another former White Sox, Liam Hendricks, just had it last year in 2023, and now he's on the Red Sox. So, again, short list, I'm very biased.
That was his second as well, too, Liam's.
Yeah, that's right. Woof, poor guy. He's been through a lot. So, Jeremy, you were a college baseball pitcher. I don't know if our listeners know that. Did you ever experience a throwing-related injury?
No. And
good.
You may find out later in our interview why. But no, I mean, I got shoulder soreness and discomfort just like anybody else did who throws that much. But no, I lucked out. I retired from throwing a baseball when I was in medical school and I was pitching on weekends because I really enjoyed it, and it started to hurt a lot in my shoulder. And I was trying to think of why, and it was because I was doing nothing but studying and I was not doing anything for my arm.
Right.
And I was like, I'm being dumb right now. So I stopped throwing. And ironically, I haven't really thrown a baseball in like a long time. I do miss it. Spring is great. Spring training is great. Whether you like baseball or not, almost everybody loves the concept of spring training and baseball coming, because it kind of is this coming out of winter doldrums, and the sign of people in baseball uniforms tells you it's about to get warm and beautiful. There's going to be baseball at all. And whether you like the game or not, it's just that it's like an optimistic moment for everybody. So this is a great episode because it makes me think we're about to get warm weather. I have one other question for you. Do you have something against the Grapefruit League, since you only mentioned the Cactus League?
Oh, which one's the Grapefruit? Is that like down in Florida?
Yeah, good guess with the grapefruit. Yeah, there are teams in spring training in Florida. A lot of them have moved to Arizona because Florida rains too much.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I am aware of that.
No, they prefer droughts.
I have nothing against...
They prefer using all the water to grow grass. All the people of Phoenix who want water and are in a drought and may not have any left, we're putting it all on spring training baseball fields.
I have nothing against grapefruit. How about that? Well, yeah, whether you're a baseball fan or a thrower yourself or perhaps the parent of a young throwing athlete, or maybe you're just a loyal Your Doctor Friends listener and you're just along for the ride, today we aim to provide more insight into how and why these injuries happen and what we can do about them. And we have a special guest, one of our personal friends and colleagues who happens to be an expert in the field of orthopedic sports medicine and particularly with throwing athletes at all levels and at their Major League Baseball level. So super excited to bring on our guest today. We love him. And yeah, I mean, Jeremy, are you ready to throw yourself into this topic or do you need a little elbow grease? Welcome to Your Doctor Friends, the show that teaches you to sniff out the garbage and answers all the questions that you wish you could call or text your doctor friend. My name's Julie Bruni.
And I'm Jeremy Allen, and we are two physicians who work at a nationally ranked practice and take care of some of the world's greatest athletes. We know that you have questions, and we want to help.
We want to be your doctor friends. And we're back. Let's welcome our esteemed guest, everyone's favorite Major League Baseball orthopedic surgical expert, Dr. Nikhil Verma. Dr. Verma, a Michigan man, was basically born in the big house, which means he went to undergrad at the University of Michigan, not that he was born in prison. He attended medical school at the University of Pennsylvania and completed his orthopedic surgery residency at Rush. And did orthopedic sports medicine fellowship at the acclaimed Hospital for Special Surgery. And he's been with Midwest Orthopedics at Rush as a sports surgeon since 2004. He's currently the head team physician for the Chicago White Sox since 2017, taking over for one of our former guests, Dr. Chuck Bush-Joseph, who you may remember from Did I Tear My Meniscus episode. I don't know. I'll have to look that one up. And is the director of the sports medicine division and is the program director for the sports medicine surgical fellowship at Rush as well. He has robust research and academic presence with tons of publications under his belt. And he's also been elected to his peers' best doctors in America every year since 2007, which is quite fitting as he is a wonderful human being and a beloved colleague of Your Doctor Friends. And Nick, welcome to the show. Thank you for humoring us. That's a humorous pun.
Thanks, guys. Congratulations on this awesome podcast.
Awesome.
I feel like you're introducing somebody else. I'm waiting for this amazing guest to show up.
Yeah, if they show up, let us know. That would be great.
I will. Otherwise, I can fill in.
Yeah.
Sounds
for now, we'll go with whoever this is.
Well, to start, Nick.
Thanks
please,
for having me.
Of course. To start, please, Nick, tell the listeners where you are right now and where you're going.
I am in my car in traffic on 9094 on the way to the airport to head to spring training.
Yay.
Yeah, well, the theme was a spring training episode, so thank you for staying on brand. And first time I've really been thankful for Chicago traffic to give us enough time to get this interview done. So this is going to be great. For those of us, Nick, who follow baseball, it kind of feels like every pitcher seems to get Tommy John surgery at some point, at least on the professional level. Can you just maybe start off and comment, like, is this a reality or is this kind of like a figment of the media making us feel like it's happening all the time?
No, I think it's happening. I think two things are happening. Number one is they are all having elbow problems and elbow surgery. And now we're getting to the realm where they had their first elbow surgery young enough that they're starting to have their second elbow surgery. And so if you look at MLB numbers, it's probably somewhere between 30 to 40%. Of all MLB pitchers will have a Tommy John procedure at some point in their career, which is just an astronomical number.
That's crazy. I mean, give us some perspective on like, where was that number 10, 20, 30 years ago? Like how much of a rise is that?
Well, 30 years ago is when the first Tommy John procedure was probably ever done in that ballpark. As we know, Tommy John was a pitcher for the Dodgers, went on to pitch for the Yankees and was the first pitcher who tore his UCL at a time when we really didn't know or understand what a UCL or Tommy John ligament was. And so a very famous sports medicine physician and baseball physician, Dr. Job, developed the Tommy John reconstruction. And so that was only something around 30 or 40 years ago. the numbers have clearly at least doubled in the last 15 years in terms of the frequency and volume of Tommy John surgery that's happening, not only at the major league level, but frankly, at all levels of baseball.
Nick, I'll correct you right there, just because I did a little bit of research for this episode, and I was surprised, and I think it's dating ourselves too, that the Tommy John surgery was in 1974. So this will be 50 years that this procedure has been in practice, and that kind of blew my hair back.
The good catch.
The person driving next to Dr. Verma right now is really surprised by that stat, giving us a little horn background there. It's wonderful to have actually a live audience for this episode. We don't always have that.
Love
yeah.
It.
So maybe let's go backwards just for a second. We've talked about Tommy John surgery, but maybe let's go back and maybe break down, kind of like pretend you were talking to a high school pitcher who's heard of, you know, Tommy John surgery, but really knows nothing else. Like, what is the ulnar collateral ligament? Why is it important?
So the elbow is a hinge joint, right? It's designed to go in two planes, which is to bend and straighten. Now at your wrist, you can also rotate front and back, but the elbow itself is really just a hinge. What happens when we throw a baseball is that hinge gets stressed side to side rather than up and down the way that you flex and extend it. And that happens in what's called layback, which is when you bring your arm all the way back into a cocking position and then generate velocity as you throw through the ball and then into deceleration. And so during that movement, there's what's called a valgus stress on the elbow, which means the elbow is forced. If I'm looking at my right elbow, it flexes up and down. It's instead going to the right, which is to the outside portion. And so in order to make sure that the elbow stays stable, there are two ligaments, one on the inside, one on the outside, that allow that hinge only to move in an up and down direction and not abnormally move side to side. That hinge on the inside is stabilized by the Tommy John ligament, which is officially known as the ulnar collateral ligament. And that's the ligament that gets put under extreme stress over and over and over again as you throw a baseball.
Nick, real quick, do we see similar injuries in softball pitchers, or do you feel like this is an injury that has the highest prevalence in baseball pitching?
So really what we see, Julie, is anybody who throws overhand is exposed to this injury. So we see it less frequently in softball pitchers. We don't see it in windmill pitchers. We see it less frequently in softball players. We don't see it in windmill pitchers, but we will occasionally see it in girls who play, or guys that for that matter, who play softball. But for example, they play second base, third base, shortstop. So they're all over the place. They're throwing a ton during practice. And then they just make one hard throw and they eventually pop the ligament. Obviously their volume of throwing is less and the velocity is less in a fielding position versus a pitching position, which is why it's less common, but it's not like it's unheard of.
It's interesting because so you're about to go take care of a baseball team. All of those people throw overhand. Presumably they all throw pretty hard, but not every one of them is going to tear their ulnar collateral ligament. So do we know anything about like why in some people it tears and in other people it doesn't?
We don't know for sure. There's a couple interesting points. Number one is we know the ligament actually gets thicker during the season. So there have been a number of ultrasound series that show that the ligament has the ability to adapt and it will change in size depending on whether a thrower is in season or out of season. Which makes sense, right? The body, fortunately, is a living, breathing creature. It's able to adapt to the stresses around you. You go to the gym, you put on muscle and you lose weight. You stop going to the gym and you go to Chick-fil-A instead and you gain weight and you lose muscle. So, you know, the ligament is no difference in terms of its ability to do that. I think there are a couple of factors that really explain why some people have a higher risk, number one, and why the frequency has gone up. The biggest factors are people are getting bigger and stronger. So, you know, you can imagine that the moment arm, we go back to our high school physics days, the torque is related to the force times the radius or the distance from which the force is extended. So the longer you get, the more force there is on your elbow. And similarly, the harder you throw, the more force there is on the elbow. So before Julie corrects me again, she can probably go back and look at average fastball velocities by decade over the last 5 years, and undoubtedly you'll see that the average fastball velocity in baseball has gone up significantly, and that translates to throwing younger and harder at even lower levels. The second thing that we've seen change is just the volume of throwing that happens from an extremely young age, because there's two problems with this ligament. One is the acute rupture, where you just throw really hard one time and it pops. But most commonly what happens is the ligament is slowly getting micro tears or degeneration over the time, to the point where you throw once and it's a pretty normal throw for you, but the ligament finally just gives out. So you can imagine that if you start throwing at 12 and between 12 and 18, you're throwing, I don't know, 10,000 pitches instead of 5,000 pitches because you're throwing year round, the ligaments is seeing that much more repetitive stress over time that is ultimately going to lead to failure at an earlier age group.
Nick, that's a great point. And I want to harken back to what you said initially, that now the age that we're seeing is that this procedure has been around for so long that and is being performed more frequently for a lot of different reasons, that, pitchers or people are throwing more and harder and more frequently, maybe at a younger age, that now we're seeing athletes maybe having their second go around with a UCL injury. We mentioned in the cold open, Shohei Ohtani, who had his UCL reconstructed back in 2018 and now is dealing with seemingly a re-injury of that ligament. This seems like kind of a brave new world as far as, the surgical management and the orthopedic management of this problem. Like, what is your response to, like, okay, now what do we do the second time around? Does it, like, it seems like a brand new problem.
Well, I think it's important that we talk about this. And just to mention, somebody that we know very well from the White Sox world, Lucas Giolito, in the last couple of days was just reported as having some recurrent elbow symptoms. He's now, I think, if I remember correctly, about 12 years out from his initial UCL surgery. So, as these surgeries start to happen earlier and as these players maybe play a little bit later in their careers, we're undoubtedly going to deal with this. But a couple points, Julie. Number one is this used to be a procedure that was pretty much confined to the professional ranks. Like, you would not be operating on high school players with Tommy Johns 15 or 20 years ago. You would be operating on minor leaguers and more commonly major leaguers, occasionally a college athlete. Now, probably the highest volume of throwers that are having this done are in the let's call it the 17 to 22 year old age group. So just the age at which a player is having this procedure is significantly going down. The second thing is, we get a lot of patients in the office, kids, and frankly, parents that come into the office and they think somehow they're going to get supercharged when you put this new ligament in, that they're going to be better than ever. It's going to be stronger. They're going to throw harder and faster. But the reality is, we can't cheat physiology. And so, yes, you might put a new ligament in. Yes, you might get them back to the same place that they were at before. There's zero evidence to suggest that they get back throwing any harder, except for the increase in velocity that may naturally occur as we get older and our mechanics improve and our strength improve. The ligament itself doesn't allow you to throw faster. But that ligament has a time clock, just like your normal ligament has a time clock. So you put that in a 24-year-old kid, and hopefully that time clock is going to get you all the way until you're done with your career at 32 or 33. You put that in a 16-year-old kid who has aspirations of playing at a college level and then potentially even a professional level, and their climb time clock starts at 16. Maybe their time clock expires at 26 or 28, right in the middle of a major league career. And that's really going to be the next epidemic, is revision Tommy John procedures, redo Tommy John procedures, because the kids coming to the league now have had their Tommy John done so early.
You hit on so many things there. So I agree. I kind of feel like there certainly has been a huge desensitization almost to the procedure in general. I'm sure that you go back, I don't know, Nick, when you were doing your training or even in your early career, and this injury was, kind of a gasp moment, and you're like, are they even going to be able to get back? And now it kind of feels like, people walk into the office or even to a baseball field or talk about professional athletes and they say, they tore their UCL, it'll be fine. It almost gets talks like ACLs these days, where it's like, it is a big injury and it has a big recovery. Do you get the sense there's been a kind of a desensitization to it?
Oh, no question. Just based on the volume, the number of kids that are having it on a team, the way that people understand it. I mean, the first thing they ask when they come in is, is it my Tommy John? And when am I getting my Tommy John? They almost expect it to be the case. I think to your point, Jeremy, on the upside is the fact that we've really refined the techniques and the rehab associated with this procedure. such that it is very reliable in the outcomes. I mean, it's 90%+ success rates of getting back to the same level of participation that they were at before. So that's a good thing. The thing that I don't really think that many parents, kids understand is the rehabilitation burden that's required after a Tommy John surgery. And secondly is, you know, when you take a 17-year-old kid and you put him through this, there's a huge psychological burden that happens, not to mention the impact on somebody's career if they're 16 or 17 and looking to play college baseball or looking to get that opportunity. And then all of a sudden in the middle of a recruiting season or cycle, have to have a Tommy John procedure. So the implications are just well beyond having to have a surgery and go through some rehab afterwards.
So real quick, I just want to touch on like what happens when it tears, you know, just generally like what are the, you don't have to get into like crazy physiology about it, but like how does it tear? Does it pop off of a bone? Does it tear in the middle? Like if you're ripping a piece of gristle? Question one. And then question two, like, okay, how do you stratify who needs to have surgery for this? Is it just if you're an overhead athlete? If it's like, what if you're me? What if you're Joe Schmo who just likes to, you know, do some yoga and run from time to time?
So three good questions there. We'll start with one. How does it tear?
Yes.
And it tears all of the above that you mentioned.
Sure.
It tears. So really there are two types of tears. One are acute tears where you take essentially a normal ligament and you pop it. Either pop it in the middle, pop it at the top where it attaches to the what's called the humerus bone or the top part of the elbow, or you could pop it at the bottom where it attaches to the ulnar bone or the bottom part of the elbow. Or you can pop it where you don't really pop the ligament, but you pull off a small piece of bone. Mm-hmm. That's actually something that happens in younger kids fairly frequently because their ligament is stronger than their bone. And so they can actually pull off a piece of bone mm-hmm. rather than tearing the ligament itself. So it can happen in many ways. The second issue is that it can happen either as a single event trauma, which means that I was feeling completely normal, great. I was in the middle of my season, having the best year ever. I wound up to throw one fastball in the seventh inning to get a guy out, and I felt a sharp pain in my elbow. I threw the next one and went into the dirt, and I couldn't throw again after that. So that's someone who has a truly acute traumatic ligament injury versus, you know, I was throwing, I was sore. I tried to throw again, was a little bit more sore, and then, you know, my velocity started dropping and my control kind of disappeared. And those are people that often have a ligament that's failing. And then, you know, finally they kind of just tear it the rest of the way, or it just gives way without a single event that they can recall that actually caused it. And then thirdly is the you and I thing, right? None of us on the call, except for maybe Jeremy on a really good day, throw above 80 for sure. And so how do we tear it? We tear it by an injury. You know, we are here in Chicago and somebody hasn't shoveled their driveway and you slip and fall and you go down on your arm and it torques the arm just the right way, or you maybe subtly sublux or dislocate your elbow and you tear the Tommy John. The people like us who tear their Tommy John are generally treated non-operatively, meaning we can exist even with a partially torn Tommy John and not have symptoms once it scars enough to allow us to move the elbow normally. Our biggest problem is we get stiff and it's painful for a period of 3 months, so we don't need surgery. If you're a high-level thrower, or if you're a gymnast who has to weight bear, if you play other sports that require throwing, such as, you know, javelin is another one, or if you're a football player like Brock Purdy, who threw his when he impacted his wrist against helmet, and in the process of throwing, his elbow was forcefully pushed in the wrong direction. If you're one of those types of people, you need surgery to fix it. There are non-operative options available. What we look at is really a couple of considerations. How old are you? How much do you throw? How long do you have left to throw? Where is the ligament torn? Is it the top, the bottom, or the middle? And how much of the ligament is involved? Is it a partial tear where there's only 10% of the ligament that's torn? Or is the thing all the way off to where there's really no ligament in continuity? So those are kind of, and then the last thing that we think about at the major league level is what time of the year is it? What's going on with the team? What's your contract status? Are you a starter? Are you a reliever? Are you a closer? You know, are you a built on velocity guy? Or are you more a touch and feel guy in terms of getting people out? You know, these are considerations that we think about in terms of how quickly we decide to jump to a surgical intervention.
You did a great job kind of talking about the psychological aspects and prepping for the rehab. So you've done the surgery. Maybe give us some insight into like what that recovery and rehab process really looks like.
So I tell all of our athletes and patients that surgery is the easy part. It's generally anywhere between, say, 40 to minutes to an hour and 20 minutes. You get an incision on the inside of the elbow. We can talk about this, and I'm sure you're going to bring it up. But nowadays, there are techniques to repair the ligament in the right circumstances versus actually reconstructing the ligaments, which means we either take a graft from somewhere else in your arm, from your hamstring just below your knee, or in some cases, a donor graft. And we use that to build a new ligament for yourself. When you go home, you have a splint on. That's like a plaster splint that stays on for about a week. Between a week and 10 days, you go into a brace that allows movement. That brace comes off somewhere between 4 to 6 weeks. You then in PT to get your motion back. You then work on strengthening of the upper extremity and the shoulder, as well as your core, to make sure you're ready to throw when that time comes. Throwing can be anywhere as early as 3 to 4 months for a repair, to about 5 to 6 months for a reconstruction. But really, you probably will not be in game shape until about 9 months if you're a position player, 12 to 14 months if you're a pitcher. So that's a long time away from the game. And remember, when you're doing Tommy John on this level of an athlete, I mean, they've committed a significant portion of their life to athletic participation. It's a part of who they are and what they do. And you take anyone away from that environment for 12 to 14 months in what can be a very lonely rehabilitation timeframe. And I don't care if you're a 17-year-old or you're a major leaguer who's been throwing it in the big league level for 7 or 8 years. It's a mental journey that athletes go through during that rehabilitation process.
I don't know if anybody's like me, but I do occasionally turn on SportsCenter, and I feel like always you'll hear also people be like, yeah, he's got a partial tear, and you're like, oh, what does that mean? So when somebody maybe doesn't have a full tear, how do you decide what to do with that?
Yeah, it's all the factors that we talked about, Jeremy. Was this your first injury or your second or third go around with this? Where's the injury located? Is it at the top or the bottom? Injuries at the top of the ligament, generally speaking, partial injuries at the top do better than partial injuries at the bottom. How much the ligament is involved? Are there any other injuries that are going on? Like, do you have a tear in the muscle overlying the ligament itself? What does your exam look like? And where are we? You know, so like, for example, if we're in January and you're going to have a surgery and you're not going to be back till next January, and we're going to give you 8 weeks to see if you can heal it. And in 8 weeks, it's going to be March. And if you have surgery in March, you're still not back till the next March. So you're going to miss the entire season anyway. Then we've got house money to play with, right? And we may be more liberal about trying a conservative approach to see if we can get you back to the season. Or similarly, if we're in August and you're going to likely miss the whole next season anyway, and we're in the middle of a playoff battle to where if we could get you back by the end of September to pitch in a postseason type situation, maybe we give that a go, assuming that we think that there's a chance of success. So there's variables that go in with the anatomy and the type of injury, and there's variables that go into it just from an individual decision-making process in combination with the player based on what their goals are.
Yeah. It makes me think of just like anecdotally, as I was looking up, you know, some stuff about in anticipation of this episode, articles about Bryce Harper and how he had his UCL reconstructed in November of 2022 and then was batting less than 6 months later for the Phillies. He struck out on his first at bat, but it's interesting how, you know, your time frame that is typical for someone who's going to return back to throwing. Perhaps there's some creative ways that at the major league level, you know, we try to integrate these players back into non-overhead throwing positions to just allow them to condition and get back to play. I mean, I think that that Bryce Harper was a bit of an outlier, but I'm sure those decisions, you know, those conversations come up a lot for people trying to get back onto the field.
Yeah, not so much, Julie. I think he's an outlier in that he's one of the rare individuals. I think he's one of the rare individuals like Ohtani, where their bat is as valuable as their arm, right? Typically, when you have a pitcher, they're not batting, you know, 300 and hitting 20 sure. plus home runs in a season. So hitting is actually pretty routinely recovered by 4 months, maybe 5 months after the surgery. You actually don't even need a UCL to hit. We had a minor league player I'm probably going back 3 years ago now, who tore his ulnar collateral ligament in probably at the end of spring. It was March or April, because I remember talking to him in the training room in Phoenix. And he was an outfielder who threw it on a single throw trying to get somebody out at home. So he was trying to gun one from the middle of the outfield home and traumatically tore his UCL at a point where we thought he was going to need surgery. But this was a kid who really needed to develop his bat almost more so than he did his arm in order to be competitive at the big league level. So we shut him down. We got his inflammation out. We got his range of motion back. He hit the entire season before he had the repair in about August, knowing that he could probably be back to a position player of baseball by April. So you can hit with an incompetent UCL. And similarly, you can get back to hitting pretty early after a UCL reconstruction. It's just very uncommon that we see these players who are undergoing UCL surgery where their bat is a major part of their game.
That was a great story, a great anecdote. You mentioned value. As being physicians for professional athletes, I think, you know, many times people kind of want to look behind the scenes, but certainly, you know, we get brought into the conversation when people are signing contracts or trades or physicals about, you know, kind of what our thoughts are on the medicals. What has been kind of the sense you've had or around with the major league physicians about whether somebody's had a Tommy John before and how it affects your concerns about them moving forward? Just because it's so common.
Jeremy, that was a great question. And there's a couple things that we look at when we're evaluating players or trying to assess injury risk, so to speak, right? Because at the end of the day, I mean, this is multi-million dollar contracts. And if you have a contract that goes south, you know, it could be $100 million plus that's sitting in the athletic training room rather than on the field. And just as a side note, you know, the number is that probably on any given year, there's almost $1 billion, $1 billion with a B, dollars worth of salary that's spent off the field during rehabilitation or injury recovery rather than playing for the team that's paying them the money. So that's why there's so much interest in baseball around this, is because there's significant lost time, which translates to lost competitive ability and also translates to lost dollars. So part of our job is to try to evaluate, you know, what's the risk of an injury to a given athlete at the time that we're signing him to a contract or draft or what have you. Couple ways that we do that. Number one is, now that we have an MLB combine, we're able to obtain imaging on many of these players so we can look at the ligament of itself, determine if it's showing any signs of potential injury, degeneration, maybe a higher risk for a future necessity for a Tommy John procedure. If they've had a prior Tommy John, how does that reconstruction look? How have they been performing? And in both situations, are they having any symptoms that may suggest that the Tommy John is either going to become a future problem or a reconstructed Tommy John is going to become one that starts to fall apart? The second thing we look at is their history and their performance data that would suggest maybe their velocity is dropping off. Maybe they've had a few stints for 10 days or so because they're having elbow soreness. Those are things that suggest to us that maybe they're in coming close to that time frame where their ligament's going to give up. We look at what is their performance level. So for me, if we've got a guy who's throwing 97 and above regularly, I pretty much tell our guys, you know, at that velocity level, the risk is at least 50%, if not more. So if you're going to sign them to a contract and they haven't had a Tommy John procedure, we probably should be thinking about budgeting in a year when they need a Tommy John. It's just the nature of the beast in baseball today. And in fact, you know, I can think of a couple people whose names that you would know that we went through at draft time. And I said, hey, you can take this guy, but, you know, in the next 4 years, budget a Tommy John. And I would say more than 50% of the time they've had a Tommy John procedure. And so some of that then goes back on the free office to the front office to say, OK, they're valuable enough that even if they do miss a year or two out of a great 10-year career, that's worth it for us to make the investment into this player.
So it sounds like your prognostication skills are maybe at least as good as Chicago's very own Tom Skilling. And he's retiring this year. So, you know, maybe if this...
Sometimes we get it right. Sometimes we get it right.
That's mind-blowing what you just said there, because I think one of the questions I think I have and what many people ask is, you know, is this inevitable? Is it going to happen? And it sounds like we maybe don't know everybody that's going to get one, but it sounds like to a certain extent it kind of is if you're throwing that hard. Is there a certain mile per hour that you said 97, but like, is there a certain mile per hour around there where people kind of know it's going to tear?
I think average basketball velocity above 96 probably, and certainly peak velocity above 100, those double the triple digit guys, they're just a ticking time bomb, in my opinion.
Wow.
I mean, they're amazing, you know, Crochet was one of them for us, right? He came in, pitched in our postseason, was pretty much lights out for, I don't know, the seven innings that he threw when he was a rookie. If you remember, during that postseason run, had a little bit of elbow pain, and then the next year blew it out. So, you know, as you do more and more of this and you take care of athletes who play baseball repetitively, you can kind of sniff it when it's coming. You see the same pattern of early symptoms and velocity drop off and things that are predicting that it's probably coming sooner rather than later.
It's one of the first times I've been thankful that I topped out at about 87 miles per hour. Kept my elbow intact.
There you go.
I think
we're
really
thankful, because otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. If I was throwing so hard, I would have been maybe under your care, Nick. Right. You would have been, I would have been like, yeah, bank a year for him to have Tommy John. I think the million, what I would have said was $1 million question, but now seems like it's a $1 billion question, is like, you know, can we prevent these? So I'm a concerned parent. I have a 14-year-old, maybe promising pitcher who's never had an arm injury. What do I do? Do I just assume that it's a risk that I'm taking and let it go, or can I actually get out ahead of it?
Yeah, so I think there's a dual answer to that question. Number one is, by the time you get to this level where you're playing in the major leagues and with the velocity that these guys have to have now to be competitive at the major leagues, there's probably not a whole lot we can do to prevent it. You know, we've often tried to look with like relievers or starters. If you remember with Carlos Rodon, we stretched out his interval from 5 days to 7 days. At some point during the season, we would give him a week or two off, particularly when we had the postseason coming up. With relievers and closers, it's really hard, because if you've got a guy who can't go back to back, or can only go one inning, you can't go an up and down, you know, in other way has to modify what they're doing, it starts to become really difficult to manage on the pitching coaches and the manager side in terms of when they're available and when they're not. So you do the best you can, but sometimes it's just inevitable at this level in order for them to be competitive and provide the team with what's needed to enjoy the success of a playoff season. In the younger kids realm, I think it is really important that we try to prevent them, or at the very least delay them, right? As we've already talked about, probably much better to have your first TJ at 22 or 23 or 24 instead of 16 or 17 or 18. And the biggest problem we've seen with these younger kids is they're throwing a lot more. They're playing on multiple different teams. They're challenging the radar gun constantly. And they're working on these velocity programs, trying to get fast and throw harder and harder and harder at an earlier age. So I think what we try to do with our younger kids is make sure they've got a break during the year. They need to have 6 weeks off maybe at the end of a fall season, and then maybe 6 weeks off between spring and summer ball, or 8 weeks off at the end of the fall season. They got to have these down periods where they're not throwing. You got to make sure that somebody is being the quarterback for their entire, what I like to call their entire throwing portfolio, meaning when they go from team to team, or they have different coaches, or they're doing, you know, throwing lessons and or performance lessons, that somebody's keeping track of what's the actual volume of throwing that's happening. And that counts things like warm-up pitches, right? For these relief guys, if they're getting hot and not throwing, I mean, they're throwing at 80, 90% velocity, which is almost as close to the load on the ligament as what you're throwing at 100% velocity. So just to prove the point, there's clear data that shows that if you throw more than 8 months out of the year, your risk is higher. And similarly, there's very good data that shows that if you come from a warm weather country, part of the country, versus a cold weather part of the country where they can play year round, their risk of Tommy John is much harder. So it's all about the volume of throwing and not being so mesmerized by the velocity early on, and not doing these kind of quick things to pick up 3 or 4 or 5 more miles of hour of velocity quickly. Those are all things that lead to increased risk of injury that are controllable when our kids are younger.
Yeah. I think that's really helpful. I feel like I'd be remiss to not mention that there is a great amount of research that's been ongoing about looking into injury prevention, as far as, one, you know, changing the, you know, how younger people are structuring, like you said, their throwing portfolio. And I think there's a lot of promise there, and there's already a lot of data. I think that we can utilize some of our technology that we already have at hand to potentially screen for, you know, different throwing patterns and movement patterns in young overhead athletes that could potentially, you know, screen out who's at high risk, higher risk for this. And I know that, you know, I would love to pitch our Sports Performance Center at Midwest Orthopedics at Rush, and I feel like they're doing a really great job to build our knowledge, our fund of knowledge on who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong. Because clearly, you know, like you talked about, Nick, sounds like 30 to 40% of pitchers in Major League Baseball will end up having this injury that we've seen so far. That means that 60 to 70% are not. So clearly there are ways that we can look at who's not having this injury and maybe understanding why they are not. And clearly there's maybe a million different reasons why that is. It's their genetics. It's their how they pitch. It's how they move. But, you know, I'd also be remiss to not mention that there, I think there's a fair amount of good data in the dynamic neuromuscular stabilization world that's been kind of bleeding into baseball. With Brett Winchester with the St. Louis Cardinals has done a lot of this research too, that I think that there's still a lot of digging to be done about accepting it as an inevitability and looking into potentially better ways to screen for young folks that might end up having this problem by looking at who didn't have it and why, not necessarily just focusing on, you know, who did have it and why. So I don't know, I'm just musing about some excitement for the future potentially.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Julie. We obviously have a strong interest in all of those things at the major league level, and that will inevitably bleed down to the lower levels as we start to establish what works and what doesn't, mm-hmm. and it becomes more available. The couple of things that we probably can't change, we certainly at this point can't change genetics. Maybe somewhere down the line, we'll be able to engineer super ligaments, but right now, no. We can't change velocity, because if you take a guy who throws 98 and say you're going to throw 94, they're no longer of the value to themselves and to the team that they were before. But there are a lot of things that we can change. And understanding, are there mechanics in throwing that predict higher risk of injury and lower risk of injury? And how do we treat that, and how do we teach that early on, right? We've seen that in the ACL world, mm-hmm. where you can do a functional sports assessment and look for motion patterns that predict injury and help to modify them so that they are of a lower risk of injury. We can't make the true risk zero, but we could decrease it. Number two is helping these kids to understand at a lower level that it's not just about throwing, right? You've got to develop your proximal strength in your hamstrings and your quads. Mm-hmm. You've got to develop core strength. You've got to be doing your program, working on your scapular stabilizers and your shoulder strength. All of your velocity and power comes from the lower body, and that gets transmitted from the upper body into the ball. So there's no question that when I see these guys, and we as a team see these guys who are diligently in the training room, in the weight room, day in and day out, doing their work, even though they're, you know, 29 and have been in the big leagues for 10 years, these are guys that are going to play well into their mid-30s and late 30s. And so putting in that work certainly will help to maintain your health and flexibility, viability, decrease injury. Third is technology. And so, you know, a lot of this is looking at how do we avoid these spikes in workload, whether that's spikes in workload to prevent hamstring injuries when we're running, or spikes in workload during intermediate times when guys are between starts, or spikes in workload during the rehabilitation timeframe, or during spring training when we're ramping up. These are times when injury risk is high, and if we can track and monitor and kind of plan out a graduated buildup in workload rather than low workload, really high, submaximal mm-hmm. workload, low workload, low workload, low workload, really high, submaximal workload, those are just putting a player at risk for injury.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt we're going to learn more and more about these things. We're going to have technology that's going to allow us to track these things. And it's coming, and it will be applied to the lower level athlete once we figure it out at the major league level. So it's not like it's all doom and gloom for the future. But at the same time, we're going to figure out how to throw even harder. And we're going to be battling guys that are now throwing mm-hmm. average fastball velocity of 100. And we'll have that to deal with. So, you know, lots of work to be done, but really fascinating to try to figure this out.
Certainly.
Yeah, I think as we wrap up here with you, Nick, I think that you've provided such great information here, but I can just feel the battle of a parent and a young child trying to figure this out, because the only way to be relevant is to be on these teams that are giving you rankings, that are giving you showcases throughout the country, and that's how you get recruited, and that's how you get to the big leagues, and the only way to do that is to be throwing really hard and pushing through the radar gun and being in these camps and being on six different teams. And so we tell them to prevent the injuries. You have to not do those things. But then if they don't do those things, they never get a chance to get to the professional level to throw out their ligament when they're older. So it just kind of feels like it's a no-win situation right now. And again, things like the showcases and Perfect Game are really profiting from it, to be honest. They're making tons of money, and it's really just putting everybody in a bind.
You make a great point, and I think part of the problem is we've created this environment whereby everybody is trying to play catch up with the Joneses, right? You can't feel good about giving your kid the best opportunity without having him on three travel teams and doing a workout session every other day, and then with a pitching coach one day and a hitting coach the next day. And that's really about the business of youth sports, which I've talked about before and I think is problematic. Not only because it forces parents into this kind of rat race, it forces kids into this rat race. It takes away from the fact that most of the kids who are playing sports are not going to play at the next level, and they're playing sports to learn all of the great things that sports teach us about being on a team and winning and losing and managing your time and dedicating yourself to training. There's so many values in youth sports that are beyond just, I'm going to get a scholarship to college or I'm going to play at the next level, that really influences mm-hmm. the vast majority of our youth athletes. And that goes away when you've got to be committed and you can no longer do the newspaper or the play because your baseball career, your basketball career takes up the entirety of your time. And I think that's unfortunate in youth sports itself. What I would tell you is I don't think there really is evidence to suggest that you have to do all the things that you're saying in order to be successful. I mean, if you look at some of the most successful athletes in the college level and the professional level, even today, many of these people, whether they're men, women, what have you, they are multi-sport athletes, right? They grew up being athletes, playing on three different sports or playing multiple sports and still were managed to be successful. You know, people like, can't believe I'm saying his name, but Urban Meyer. And of course, our friend Jim from Michigan. I mean, these are looking for the highest profile athletes, and they put a privilege or a priority on multi-sport athletes. There was just to give a shout out to my peeps, there was an Indian kid who got drafted in the first round last year as a shortstop for Toronto.
Amazing.
You know, his parents came from India, really had no idea about this whole youth system. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you that kid was in the spelling bee as much as he was playing baseball.
I love it.
They figured it out as he went along. And the reality, he was a talented kid, and the talent gets picked up when you have it. So I think there is a role for all of these things. I think that, you know, obviously kids love to play and we want to give them those outlets. But I really don't think that you have to be forced into that cycle of trying to keep up with your neighbors to give your child the best chance of success at whatever sport they're playing.
Nick, very well said.
Nick, I know we're wrapping up here. Just from what you said right there, I feel like you would really enjoy one of our former guests, Linda Flanagan, who wrote a book called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. I feel like you could write a foreword for her next book, potentially.
Yeah, I gave a TED Talk on it about 5 or 6 years ago. Very similar topic. Sounds like we probably hit on some of the same points.
Sure.
But, you know, when you see private equity investing in youth sports leagues, you've got a problem. You've got a problem. It's no longer about the kids. It's about generating money. And if you're going to build a sports complex or a hockey rink, you can't have hockey just happening in the winter months, right? You've got to be hockey from 6 in the morning to 1 a.m. all season, all year, all the time in order for that to make money. And that's where the problem comes in. But, you know, it's another discussion for another day, as you say, Julie.
Certainly.
Yeah. I think we'll let Nick get on his plane to go help our White Sox hopefully avoid all of these injuries that he's talked about. The recent mind bomb that went off in my head was somebody said to me, or I was listening to, and said, how do we define success for our kids? And it has been screwing with me ever since, because this is another example of, like, when we put the finish line where we put it, we can really screw up why we wanted them to play sports in the first place. So really appreciate the time, Nick. Thanks for spending all the time in traffic, and look forward to putting out the episode and hopefully a winning season this year, if you don't mind adding that.
We'll do our best, Jeremy. You know, just as a last parting note, I always tell my kids, I didn't really find my passion in orthopedics until I was, you know, in my mid-20s. And then something just clicked. And since then, it's just been what I love to do. And so, you know, kids find it at different ages. And I think that we don't always give the kids the benefit of the doubt that they deserve in terms of letting them spend the time to find their passion. That's my last comment.
Thank you so much, Nick. Julie, that was a really fun interview with Dr. Verma, with Nick. For everybody who was listening, you could tell he was he's a multitasking man who is on his way to try to treat the White Sox. So if it's not the audio quality you come to expect from your doctor friends, hopefully the content makes up for the audio quality, because I thought the content was great. And we do this for a living. You and I see this all the time. We're physicians for the team. We treat athletes every single day. I see elbow injuries right around now like crazy. I learned a ton from that. I mean, there's so much to learn.
I agree. And I think it's so great to be in this multidisciplinary practice. I'm not trying to plug where we work, but it is wonderful to have collaborative efforts like this to take care of athletes at all levels. And it's, you know, again, like, it's not just our overhead throwing athletes, although they are at the highest risk. But like, just recently I had a collegiate cheerleader who had this injury from tumbling, you know, and like Nick mentioned, it's gymnasts, it's people that walk on their hands, you know, so I think it involves a large swath of people. And it's also for anybody who follows sports, and particularly baseball that's coming up right now, like, it, I think it's nice to have some insight into, like, why does this happen? Peeking behind the curtain a little bit and having someone who is on the, you know, on the team helping make medical decisions for this, and also in the field of research who's trying to understand and publish things about how we can treat this effectively and potentially, hopefully, prevent it at some stage. And I do think that's like every other, like how we end a lot of other episodes about, you know, disease management and injury management is, gosh, you know, we cannot stop putting time and effort into looking into prevention of problems. And it's not too hard. And if we keep talking about it and keep drumming up interest in it, prevention is sexy. This saves people time, money, suffering, all of the above. And that applies to ulnar collateral ligament injuries as much as it is when we talk to Greg Dodell about prediabetes. So prevention is sexy. It's key. I'm never going to stop talking about it. I think it's worth our time and effort and conversation.
Yeah. And I would like to plug, I don't think we made this plug in the interview, but if the Pitch Smart guidelines can be really helpful for people looking for, you know, I think one of the things that he brought up was a lot of bringing down the amount of throwing that you're doing and taking time off and making sure that you're doing, you know, appropriate amounts of arm care and such. And the Pitch Smart guidelines were put together by some of the leading researchers throughout the country, including Dr. James Andrews, who's obviously very famous for doing a lot of these surgeries. Mm-hmm. And these guidelines are meant to, based on age level and performance, give you some actual, you know, actionable items, like what's my pitch count and how much should I be throwing during the year. So I would encourage you to check those out. It's pitchsmart.com is the website. I think ultimately speaking, Nick said this, but I think it's a really powerful statement. When you have a 26-year-old who's in the major leagues, who's theoretically getting paid pretty handsomely to do this job, tear their ulnar collateral ligament, that's one thing. When you have a 16-year-old who may or may not make it even to a college scholarship, let alone to a place where that person's going to be making money, get this surgery and have probably, I mean, you're never going to have a normal elbow again, whether you like it or not. If you go through the surgery, you can get back to normal throwing, but it's always going to be a post-operative elbow. It's always going to be different than the one you were born with, and that has long-term complications. You know, again, I think we got to reorganize our priorities here and say, like, if this is inevitable, we need to keep it out of 16, 17, 18-year-olds. Right. I liked how he said the words almost like delay it, because I think for a long time we've been trying to prevent it. And that's not to say stop that, but delaying it seems like something we could be doing right now. This shouldn't be happening to kids.
Agreed. And again, like, I know I talked with Nick about how he should read Linda Flanagan's book, and maybe I'll bring a copy in on Monday when I see him in the office, because I think we're all in alignment here of, there are a lot of forces that are exploitative towards young athletes, and it's not fair and it's not okay. And I think we can be loud on the advocacy side of things as well. And I think there are a lot of great people doing great work to minimize risk for young people, because you're right, it's not just a physical, I had this injury, now I have to have the surgery. Like Nick mentioned, this is a huge psychological toll for people. And remember, like, what Linda said and what Nick just said too, like, sports is supposed to be fun. We're doing this to learn how to build resilience and how to enjoy being part of a team, and like learning that winning is fun and losing is bad, but it's okay that if you do both of them and life goes on. And how sports can really enrich our lives. And when you take that away from a young person, you're just doing them a giant disservice. And in the end, we don't want to see them in our offices. We want these kids to be on the field, not coming in because, they're all bruised and broken. And it's just sad.
What a great episode. I am looking forward to the warm weather. I want you, the listener, to both subscribe and leave us a review, but then also anybody who is heading to spring training or going to a baseball game, take a selfie or a picture of you at that stadium and then share it with us on Instagram. Your underscore doctor friends. It would be awesome to kind of be able to put together a little collage of our listeners going to all the different games. And we can kind of add ours to that too. So as we leave into the eternal optimism of spring, remember that taking care of your elbow as a pitcher is really important. And while it may feel inevitable, there may be some prevention that we can do. And so always, to get your information on Learn How to Prevent Disease, listen to your doctor friends.
The amazing music is credited to SkillCell with Pixabay licensure. The podcast is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast should not be taken as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Please consult a medical professional for any medical issues that you may be having. The contents of this podcast are the opinions of the hosts only and do not reflect the opinions of their employers or affiliations. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Under no circumstances shall Dr. Julie Bruni or Dr. Jeremy Allen or any guest to the podcast be responsible for damages arising from use of the podcast.